Well, why don't we take our seats and begin to struggle with this again? I think everybody's here, actually. Yeah. Well, I think everyone's here. Let me remind you of the procedure that I think we agreed we should follow this morning. There were opening statements by all of those members of the roundtable who joined us yesterday for the first time, and they were indeed fascinating. And we had begun to canvass the table opposite me for some observations and questions, and I promised we would continue along those lines this morning. And perhaps this morning we could hear from Mr. John Hope, Mr. Alfred Starr, Mr. Fred Paul, and then Mr. Peterson, if he has further questions, and then Mr. Malott and Mr. Johnson. And then perhaps ask our guests who joined us yesterday to take a full opportunity to respond to what has been said already and what is going to be said this morning. So, one other thing, we have invited the public to participate. It's difficult to work them in, but I hope we will be able to give the public an opportunity late this afternoon members of the public to say something. We allowed that to be done late in the afternoon on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, and perhaps we can work that in this afternoon later on. Well, Mr. Hope, perhaps you would begin this morning then, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was fascinated by some of the remarks made yesterday. My remarks will be more comments than questions. I was, I guess, shocked, probably is the term, when I heard there was a proliferation of IRAs since 1966. And I think in the eyes of the state of Alaska, and perhaps Senator Stevens, two new IRAs constitute a proliferation. 1966, there have been only two IRAs who had elections called by the secretary. One was the Inupiat, and the other was the Kainaitse people. There were more than nine IRAs in 1966. The job I had when I was at the Bureau was to help the tribes form IRAs. There have been only two. There have been at least, well, during my tenure, there are at least 12 applications that are still sitting in Washington. The other comment that, and Mr. Hickok comes with real force and authority, and if I didn't know better, I probably would have believed that. The one sovereign concept I found, I was really pleased the Supreme Court doesn't agree with Mr. Hickok that there is but one sovereign. Some of the things the court has said with respect to sovereignty, the sovereignty which a tribe has is of a unique and limited character, but retains all the attributes it had, which has not been expressly limited by Congress. 1978 Supreme Court said in part, the power of Indian tribes are in general inherent powers of a limited sovereignty which has never been extinguished. That's inherent. I heard Senator Stevens the other day say the federal government is about to give a lot of sovereignty in Alaska. Supreme Court thinks it's inherent, that nobody gives it to you, they can recognize it. I guess the part that I would probably take issue with, because I believe that tribes do have sovereignty, not with Mr. Hickok's statement, but with the rule of international law that states the rule of discovery and conquest gives the conqueror sovereignty and ownership over the lands thus attained. And so, because that's a rule that we live under, we are burdened with the limitations it imposes. And true justice, I believe, would fault that statement. Mr. Van Ness said the IRAs would be a mistake. It has a bad record. It's an instrument of the 30s. I think the IRA has application in the current time because the problems the IRA was intended to address are the problems that we still have today. And I think there are some general statements, and I don't think, at least I had some dealings with IRAs, and I think that probably, if I were you, Mr. Chairman, I would make a visitation to Metlakatla. There's an IRA and there's a reservation. And I think you might get a different perspective than what we've been hearing about bad IRAs. The other IRA community that's strictly IRA in Southeast Alaska is Klakwan. They used to have a reservation. They have refused to incorporate under state statutes. They still operate an IRA entity, and I think they're satisfied with it. Those are two communities, but if you were to just listen to testimony and say these vehicles are poor vehicles and should not be foisted upon us, I think it would pay you well to visit. And as I said the other day, I think if you talk to the people down there in Metlakatla and you say, we have a great act here intended to do wonders for the peoples of Alaska, we'd like for you to have the opportunity to avail yourself, I think probably you would not get an affirmative response. I think they're pleased with the instrument they have. And it's also a reservation. A lot of people condemn reservations. I think you would be impressed with the physical appearance of that community. You've heard a lot of negatives about reservations, and I think unless you visit one, I don't think you could have a fair judgment of what those things are. It was interesting to me to hear Mr. Jones say that it was the express intent for the shares to go out of non-native hands. Said that's what we wanted. The first few days, I think we were blaming the native leadership for that. But now I think I'm beginning to place it in the right perspective. And he said, when you lose land, that's what we wanted. You'll get money in return, you know. I guess from a native perspective, that's not a plus. That probably is minus. If I had a choice of money or land, probably I wouldn't think that was a fair exchange. I was really fascinated by that concept. I think, Mr. Chairman, those are the things that I wanted to jump up and respond to yesterday, but keeping with the decorum that you've established here, I have probably one more ulcer develop overnight. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Hope. Mr. Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The round table. A round table, people that sit around a round table. You're trying to tell the not only the Alaskan natives, but the population of Alaska as a whole. And before the white man came, the Indians did the same thing, the leaders. And I, from way back, my great grandfathers were the chiefs of the natives. And they didn't have no Washington, D.C. They didn't have Juno. And they didn't have the white man. But they ran their country. The economic problem in this country, in Alaska, there was nothing ever done about it. And I'm glad that you mentioned some economic problem started here. The other parts of the world, there's some parts of the world where they're overpopulated and they haven't got the timber or anything else that we got up here. And it's funny that Alaska never exported anything to any other part of Asian countries where those are needed. I'm going to tell you a little story about the old Indian rules and laws. Rapids, Alaska Blue Rampart, was a fishing ground. And they had a dip nets made out of willows. It was made out of willows. And they fish there during July, the king salmon runs. And they had a rock there. It's still there. Rock is still there where they dipped it from. Every person that went over there, and they came from the Tanana River, up Yukon River, and down the river, not only for the people there at the Tanana district, that part of it. They came from all over, those that could travel. And once I put in a month or so of fishing, they were allowed to fish. And it don't, some say they'll listen 10 minutes that they caught two fish there, two king salmon. And they get in a canoe when they kiss that two fish. And somebody, the village was on the other side, the camps was on the other side. Somebody get in the canoe over there and come over and take his place. 24 hours a day. And when you, Mr. Parker here, I know him in 1930s or 40s, I think. And when they have a game law, things like the Copper River Center where they're dipping it. If it's too much, too many people getting to the people of places like that, they could overfish. You should be allowed so many people at all to get in there because they're going to be over. And about the Indian land, the natives is worried that they're going to lose their land in 1991 because they can't pay tax. And in 1961, before the 1962 meeting in Canada, the first Indian meeting in Interior, Alaska, I worked with the university people when they asked me what the Indian land would be reservation. I think the reservation, if it's got to go back to reservation, I like to see them keep their land because they can't live without land. And I'll tell you about, I'm here to tell you a little story, which is true. And not too many people back here to listen to talk to either, you know. I like to talk to a big crowd of people. That's what the Indian chiefs is for. I don't know what. The first white man that came up the river was a Russian. And they said they came up Forest New Lotto, where they started trading post, or they didn't have nothing but tea, I guess, and I don't know what else. Maybe the old Muzzleloader gun shells. I wouldn't be surprised if, I wouldn't be sure if they even had a pilot, but if they had it in these Russian traders had. He was some big shot down there, so Russian, you know, was going to go up and look at the other parts of Alaska. And he got a native, which was a slave, you know, he didn't pay him. And he came Blue Tanana, which is he's got a bar down there called Tozy's. It's good fishing there too, you can fish there. It'll fall under the ice. But there was an Indian there from upriver. He lost his son, drowned it. So he went down, he was looking for his son. And this Russian big shot. He was a, I don't know what that, what you'd call him. He had a fire on a beach there at Matatozzi. And this Indian with him told this man coming down in a bush by a canoe, there was no, nothing but bush by a canoe then, to go, he talked in a Nulato language, that's the Basque language, and told him to go back, because this man told him to go back, the Russian told him to go back, he got a business down there, turn around, go back up river. And he kept a going. And again, there's not too many young natives. I usually talk to young natives because I like the, I like them to know the old time stories and what happened before the white man came. And there's not too many here this morning. I should talk when they all come in this afternoon before they're. In these days, they had two knives. What the knife was made of, I don't know. Maybe Mr. Hoop or there's some other name, Mr. Paul here. Maybe they know. So they made out of stone, it was sharp enough so they could eat with it. They had two knives. One was to eat with, one was to. Knife they can defend themselves with in case they get in trouble. He landed there. He didn't go back. He landed. He didn't pull his canoe up very far, but he did come to the fire. He was caught. The big Russian got up, you know. He's a white man, you know, Russia, you know, I don't know. He's a white man, and, you know. Why he broke the law when he was told to go back, he should have went back. He was going to kick him. And he got willing out so quick, you know, and went down to his feet. Well, he did. He pulled his feet back. He waited for the call. He was going to kick me with the other foot. He done the same with another knife. Then he was going to hit him. He done the same thing with the knives, you know. So he sat back on this box and he asked this new ladder native, I guess, what he's doing around here. And we can talk the same dialect from Tanana's at New Ladder, increase forest contact, and little Devick, if any. People have been on Yukon River, you know. I lost my son, he told us native, I lost my son, I'm just looking to see if I can find a body. Well, the Russian got sorry for him. And the Russian told him that you go on one side, didn't even cup of tea, he never had tea left, and he was sitting on a box, and never seen box in his life, you see. So the Russian boss told him, we go on one side, and you go on the other side, and if you find your son, make sign to us. And if we find him on this side, we will make sign to you. I guess he would go on the other side then. And he turned back. But the Russian sent word back to Russia and told the Russian government that I was going to go up river and look at the rest of the Yukon River, see what the natives up there, who lives up there. But it looked like the warriors up there that maybe we couldn't, I couldn't go up there with a few since I got here. The Russian government told them, don't go up there. That's their land. That's their land. They lived there for thousands of years. And we're not going to go up into their land. They will gradually will find out that we're here through the Muklak Dutch or Social Wisdom Days, you know, they didn't. And the Russians never went up.
No,
you can't remember. So again, I'm glad that you mix with the natives. I'm talking to the whites. You mix with the natives, but you're talking about people's lives, about their future. And I would say that the Indians should keep their land some way or another. It shouldn't be taxed unless they make money on it. Unless a mine or something, they find oil or something on it. But the Indians in Alaska were it. And about the jobs, I look downtown here, after look downtown, I go to different coffee shops, different business places, and I don't see no natives working down here. And in the villages, it's nice to see the natives, the clerks, the girls, they're very nice. And they're just like anybody else. They're just working people, they're nice. So it's too bad that not too many natives working there. That's all I'll see. Mr. Paul, he's a lawyer, and he'll tell you about the old time. No, he'll tell that to you about it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Starr. Thank you very much, sir. Well, Mr. Paul, Mr. Starr has introduced you, and...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a number of sort of miscellaneous points before I go into the political process. There's an inherent contradiction in the Settlement Act. The extra corporations got their property, whatever they got, because of tribal rights. So that in the management and operation of the corporations geared towards profit have had a tendency to forget the origin of whatever they have. We hear the comment, corporation for profit, which is totally opposite from the tribal creation of the property that the corporation has. So that management in the corporations have problems in satisfying the desires of the rank and file tribal members, which we now call stockholders. The legal rights, the trust responsibilities that the U.S. Supreme Court has time and time again recognized really didn't gain much support in the Native movement. We used to say the words, but it was hardly ever manifested into the actual wording of the legislation. It wasn't until Don Wright became president in the fall of 1970 that with his support people began to focus upon the trust relationship. He brought up leaders from the lower 48 He was instrumental in getting Bob Jim of the Yakima tribe and in promoting a very substantial loan to the AFN, $225,000 in the spring of 1970. Don's involvement in the NCAI likewise produced some support for the trust theory. It wasn't really until February of 1969, with the release of the Federal Field Committee report, that there came about a sort of a general acceptance. Somebody mentioned a general acceptance of legal rights in the natives in the ownership of their land. I cannot commend the staff of the Federal Field Committee too highly. Dave Hickok and Doug Jones, and especially the chairman, Mr. Fitzgerald, for the Federal Field Committee in its report explicitly recognizing, and I can quote the phrase, first there had been a number of withdrawals, federal withdrawals, and that land was gone. But it boiled down to, instead of 375 million acres, it boiled down to 275 million acres, which the Federal Field Committee said the natives of Alaska have a substantial claim. That's their language, not mine. I'm going to advert to the political process shortly, but with respect to whether or not there would have been a settlement at all had it not been accomplished in December of 1971. One of the problems the natives of Alaska had, we had no money. Lawsuits cost money. When the Presbyterians gave a grant to the Arctic Slope Native Association of $85,000, in September 1971, it took us, I think, 10 days to get Edwardson versus Morton on file. That case was directed at the Secretary of the Interior to require the Secretary to perform his duties, his trust responsibilities, to bring an action against all of the invaders of the North Slope to eject them. Had there been no legislation, that would have been a viable alternative. Now, with respect to Joe Ubiksound and Etook's plea for corporations, one must put it in the context of the time. As of then, the natives did not have any desire for regional corporations. We had a choice of a statewide and village corporations. The Arctic Slope wanted a region. They felt that they were one people, and they would protect all of the people through a regional corporation. The Arctic Slope was not getting any support for either the regional concept or for their IRA desire as the mechanism to receive the yield of the settlement. One has to be contemporary, and the next best vehicle would be a regional corporation. And we were successful in the Senate bill of 1970, S-1830, of having created a, quote, North Slope Native Corporation, unquote. The AFN leadership and the Congress and General Counsel to the AFN gave us a little sop in the North Slope Native Corporation in giving the Eskimos 500,000 acres of surface rights. There's not much value on surface rights on the slope, particularly of that small size. We were able to convince on our own, however, when the bill got to the floor of the Senate to convert the 500,000 acres to fee simple acres. I want to talk a little bit about the Alaska Federation of Natives. Let's take a look at it prior to the settlement. The initial bill endorsed by the First Chiefs Conference, out of which the AFN grew, was based upon land lost. The court would, the bill provided that the Court of Claims would define the area of ownership still in the possession of the respective native groups so that you'd have a court decree setting forth meets and bounds. And for lands already expropriated by the United States, they would be paid some money. The other natives of Alaska realized that if the Eskimos were to get a share of their aboriginally held lands, that perhaps the others would not get anything. I never understood that because I have a belief that the natives have a pride of ownership in whatever land they have. But the Alaska natives are becoming somewhat westernized. They're losing some of their commonality of ownership within their respective tribes. So that shortly the voting procedure of the AFN was based upon a population proportion basis. The Lake Slope Native Association opposed that because with the population being concentrated in the Klinkenhaitis and in the Bethel area, the AFN in its propaganda to the Congress would swallow up the smaller regions, smaller in terms of population. Copper Center, Arctic Slope Native Association, Aleuts, they would get the smallest. Then we now have the settlement. And initially, I was most impressed with John Borbidge Jr.'s remark about freedom in corporate elections. Particularly with the regions, there is no freedom of corporate elections, none. Management, and this is the nature of the beast throughout the United States in the corporate world, management can spend corporate money to reelect themselves, and they do. Some of the larger regions will spend as much as $100,000. They have TV ads, they have radio ads, they have solicitors, they have airplanes, they have free telephone, and they hire girls to go around to the bingo games, and they pester the old ladies until they sign another proxy. Now, the structure of the AFN Inc. after the settlement is based upon representing the regions. The village people have no representation in AFN Inc. You have 12 directors representing the regions. Even the AFN convention has no power. According to its constitution, it's a great fellowship time, and that serves a function. Natives like to get together, see their old schoolmates. But there is no voice within the AFN Inc. for the village people. I was most impressed with Frank Peterson's plea to the commissioner to listen to the village people. Now, when you translate the lack of freedom in corporate elections into the AFN Inc. as it is composed today, you really have AFN espousing the desires of the respective managements of the regions. Now I want to go on to the political process. In pre-settlement, the natives of Alaska had quite a bit of clout. They had legal rights, particularly after the Federal Field Committee report was issued. They had the Udall land freeze, and it was of sufficient clout. Somebody mentioned Bill Foster's lobbying on behalf of the oil companies during the last year of the settlement. As far as I know, the oil companies did not oppose any of the desires of the AFN during that last year, any of their major desires. As far as I know, the orders that Bill Foster had was to get a settlement, any kind of a settlement. It didn't matter what it cost. By that time, the pressure on the oil companies was immense. They had spent $900 million for some so-called oil exploratory rights in September of 1969. And I might mention that the state of Alaska was so frightened of the legal rights of the natives that in the leases that the oil companies bought for that $900 million, there was a disclaimer clause. That is to say, if the state of Alaska didn't have any authority to sell those oil rights, the state of Alaska did not have to return the money. That's what you call clout. Edrickson versus Morton was filed in the last year of the pre-settlement. And there was an article in the Newsweek magazine which indicated that maybe the natives of Alaska did, under American law, own all of Alaska. That kind of publicity is political clout. It worries people. What kind of pressure do we have today? I was most impressed with Bill Van Ness's remarks about what possibility is there to get some really substantive improvements on the Settlement Act. We don't have the land freeze. Title up here is pretty much fixed. I've got to respond a little bit to the subsistence remarks of Doug Jones. Obviously, subsistence is a very, very important matter to the Alaskan Natives. It was never a ploy during the settlement effort. It was never something we threw out to gain sympathy. It was a very real thing. That was not the problem, however, about subsistence. The problem, as of then, was that some powerful figures wanted to have subsistence rights as the real compensation that the Alaska Natives would receive in the extinguishment of their rights. There were real efforts. Chairman Aspinall, in his in-house explanation of H.R. 3100 in the spring of 1971, mentioned that in his bill they gave subsistence rights and that that was put in for, quote, psychological reasons, unquote. In other words, to fool people that maybe the natives were really getting something of substance. One more thought before I leave the political process problem. There is an inherent conflict between the regions and the villages and the acts of corporations. One brief illustration is gravel. Who owns the gravel? Is gravel subsurface or surface? And gravel, in many areas, is very valuable. There's major litigation been had and still going on about the ownership of the gravel, part of the $50 million in attorney's fees that I mentioned earlier. Now, the only thing we have going for us for improvements on the Settlement Act, we don't have any real pressure like a freeze. All we have is justice. Not so shabby a thought. But I'm cynical enough to say that the Congress does not enact laws simply because they're just. Congress reacts to pressure. Congress understands power. And this beautiful ideal we have of justice is not that kind of power. Well, that's pretty strong. It's an awfully hard job to sell to the Congress something that is not at a crisis level just for the sake of justice. I have a belief that